Welcome to Episode 5 of Working Title Podcast. I'm Joshua Paul King. My interviewee is Padma Venkacharman, and she will be a speaker at the upcoming annual James River Writers Conference. After reading her lovely novel, A Time to Dance, I reached out to her and was delighted that she would join me for a conversation. We discuss each of her three novels and topics including poetry, dance, oceanography, and faith. Enjoy! Excited. So I thought we'd start with the book that I read of yours. I think this is your third, A Time to Dance, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I thought it was very lovely. Can you tell me, how the story came about and why you told it in verse?
Certainly. That's two questions. So I'll try to remember to answer both of them. And if I don't, then remind me. But the way the story came about was... There are several things that happened relatively recently. I went back to India where I was born, and I frequently go back to visit. And when I was there, I saw a dance performance, but it was not the usual kind of dance performance that one sees. It was not where the dancers were trying to entertain the audience. It was instead a dance performance where the dancers came together to try to elevate the audience to feel something more than what they were actually seeing. So really to elevate them to a spiritual plane. And it was most interesting to me because people of all the different spiritual faiths in India, so Christianity, Hinduism, of course, Islam, different religions had come together and were dancing on the stage together in this way. And I thought this was very, very powerful. And also, after that, I saw somebody that I'm related to distantly who is a dancer, a Bharatanatyam dancer, which is the classical Indian dance form, but someone who had been told that she would never be able to do this particular form of dance again that she loved, because of a disability, and then overcame that and continued to dance. So those two things sort of stuck in my mind, and it, in a way, something else that had happened a very long time ago in my life, I think, fed into this story, and that was that when I was about 18 or 19, the end of my teen years, I was bitten by one of the most poisonous snakes in India.
Oh, my.
And, yes. And usually people who get bitten by it don't live to tell the tale. But clearly I did.
Oh, thank God.
Yes. Otherwise I might have had to ghostwrite the novel in a literal sense. I think at that time when I almost lost my life, but I also almost lost my leg. And to me, despite all the pain and all of that, it was an experience that made me really think a great deal about all that lies sort of beyond the material world. And it crystallized inside of me a sense of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so the novel, as I started to write it, became one that was not, the usual sort of novel that I shouldn't say that way. It's not to put it down, but there are several books that are about a person with a disability who, overcomes it in some way or something like that. And that was not at all the kind of book that I wanted to write. There are mixed feelings about those sorts of books, mm-hmm. but it was not the kind of book I wanted to write at all, because to me, this person was just this girl that went through a series of changes, if you will, in the way that she learned what love was. So Veda, the girl in my novel, as you know, goes through really Eros, which is, the ancient Greeks thought about three different stages of love, if you will. Eros, which is physical love or carnal love, and we put that down sometimes. But to me, in this story, it's all about Veda learning to love her physical body, which I think is such a very important thing for anybody to do. and progressing then to charis, which is love of others, which Veda learns as well, because she becomes a dance teacher and starts to give dance to other people. And agape, which is just love of the other, if you will, of God or good, however you want to define that. And to Veda, art, dance becomes a means of communicating with something deeper and higher than herself. And that's what Bharatanatyam is really supposed to be. And of course, at the beginning of the novel, she doesn't quite get that. So that to me was her journey. And it's a, I think it's a very unusual theme. It's something that usually people don't touch, because I think it's the hardest type of story to tell for an author. And if I had known that, I probably would never have embarked on the journey, but I'm very glad that I did.
And what about the verse? Why in verse versus just a regular narrative story?
Thank you. That's a lovely question. And there were a couple of reasons. The first one, which is the easiest, which is kind of a cheat, is to say that her voice appeared to me in that fashion. Mm-hmm. But while that's true, there has to be something more than that, because as all of us writers know, there's that moment of inspiration when you feel that you're in the flow and you're hearing this voice or maybe seeing this movie and you're just sort of transcribing. But then there's also the other thing that happens, which is your editorial mind, and you have to come in and then look at what you wrote, and sometimes it's a bunch of garbage. So so I looked at it, and I didn't think it was rubbish, but I was a little worried, because my training, Joshua, is in oceanography, which I also love very much. So for a very long time, I didn't really speak the language of literature, if you will. I spoke more the language of numbers. So I did question why I was writing this way and if I had any right to write this way. And I was encouraged by several people, by Stephen Roxburgh, who is one of the most marvelous editors in the entire world, is now retired and no longer publishes, but is kind enough to look at my work, which is absolutely a compliment. The person, you know, Stephen has published everybody from Isaac Bashevis Singer to Madeleine L'Engle to Roald Dahl. So he's really quite brilliant.
Very remarkable. Very, very honored. I can understand that, being honored like that. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, that was very big. And Richard Blanco, who you might remember, was the poet who actually was the inaugural poet for President Obama. Mm-hmm. And is a Cuban-American poet. And before he became that famous, was kind enough to look at my work. And then we've had some wonderful people actually come to URI. Greg Pardlow, who got the Pulitzer in poetry actually a few years ago, and so on. And my colleagues, Peter Covino and Scott Hightower, who's actually at NYU, were very have just been encouraging throughout. And I think that helped me as well feel as though, yes, I could experiment with form. And to me, the form came also, I shouldn't start it like that. All right, let me get back into the flow for a second.
Uh-huh, sure.
The most important thing to me was that as these people encouraged me, I started to see that the form was the only way, really, to me, to express spirituality, because if you put too many words in, then it often becomes, you know, very religious and narrow in that way. And what I wanted to achieve was something broader, something that would be able to touch anybody, no matter what their religious background was. And because I just see, you know, religions as different ways to the same thing. So to me, it didn't want it to be something that restricted, something that came off as sort of proselytization or, you know, an advertisement for any kind of religion per se, but just rather something that was transcended and went beyond those differences. And to me, poetry is such a wonderful form because it looks at space, and white space is as important as the words that you use. Mm-hmm. And I think that play, that growth that you have, spiritual growth, occurs in a place that is wordless. And a poem you know, has that wordless space inside for spiritual growth to occur. And I think that was just what was most important to me. And I realized that that form mattered so well with the theme. And also, I started to see that with dance as the other thing that was driving the novel, verse and dance, obviously verse plays off of rhythm in a way that dance does. So that, again, was something that I think worked very, very well in terms of this novel.
It did, certainly.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, I think you had really gorgeous lines throughout. And I can certainly see the parallel between, now that you pointed out, verse and dance, the rhythm and so forth, meter.
Right. Right, and I think, you know, sometimes there's this debate that goes on in the literary world about whether a verse novel is really is poetry or not, and to me, the labels really don't matter that much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes verse novelists get very, 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 very annoyed if I say this, but I think it's a hybrid form, and it's neither this nor that. In a way, it's just its own form, because it isn't and it shouldn't necessarily try to be what poetry is, which is each piece is completely isolated and can stand alone. That's not what you're trying to do at all, I think, with a verse novel. You are trying to build an arc in the way that a novelist tries to build an arc. Character becomes extremely important. Plot is very important. And if it were just a collection of poetry, those things aren't important in the same sort of novelish way.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's a bit of a different form, but yeah, I think it suited this novel very nicely.
It did. In your writing, was there anything that did you have apprehensions about writing a novel like this? Or any of your books? Were there any fears or surprises, for that matter? Did anything surprise you in writing these books?
Well, I think I mentioned that before we got cut off, that I was a little worried about poetry, because I thought, you know, here I am with my training in oceanography. I really, in a way, have no business writing novels, let alone writing a novel in verse. And as I said, that was very, you know, I just thought about all those people who had really, really encouraged me, and that was very supportive and wonderful. And yeah, I've been very fortunate, I think, that my work has been so well received. I feel very grateful.
Well, good. And how did you do that? How did you go from oceanographer to writer?
I think in a way I used to always write, in the sense that I used to always read.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's very important.
Oh, yes.
You know, and, you know, usually you find, or sometimes actually I should say, when I lecture at colleges where there are writers who are young, I often hear this refrain about, or even high schools, this feeling that you shouldn't read too much because then you'd be influenced. And I think that's ridiculous. You would laugh if an artist ever said to you, I'm never going to step into a museum because I don't want to be influenced. You know?
Right.
That sounds so ridiculous. And yet young writers sometimes say this and think that that's fine. And I just think that's nonsense.
I agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the reason that I could make that shift was because I love to read, present tense. I read a great deal, and ultimately I think reading is one of the best teachers, one of the best ways to get to writing is that. And also I love writing. It's not to say I don't love what I used to do at all, but I love writing. I love the process of writing, and I think I'm very lucky to be able to do that.
That was one of my questions. What about writing that you enjoy most doing? Is it thinking of the story? Is it creating the characters? Is it research?
I think I like I love the process of writing. Today is a case in point. I sat down, I think about 9 o'clock or something. I didn't have too many distractions, but I wrote and I rewrote, and then I wrote, I think, at the end of the day, at 3 o'clock, I suddenly realized that I've been sitting there writing for hours, and I had to stop and pick up my daughter, get her off the bus, and I'd only written about a page or two. So, you know, they say time flies when you're having fun and all of that, and I think I have a lot of fun when I write. I don't see myself as developing the characters so much, which I know sounds very odd, but I feel as though they show up in my mind. I do feel, and in a very sort of ridiculous sense, I do feel sort of possessed mm-hmm. by them and by their story, and sometimes I just feel that I'm trying to tell someone else's story as best I can, to listen to them.
I can certainly sympathize. Yeah, I feel like my head's crowded with all these people that they demanding their story to be told. So, and that's what I love most is the characters. That's what I enjoy reading about, and that's what I enjoy writing about.
So. Right.
Now, with this story and your prior novels, how long did each novel take to write a first draft?
Climbing the Stairs, which was my first novel, it's set in India in the 1940s, and it was something that probably took me about 5 years to write. It's loosely based on my own family history, mm-hmm. so most people know, or if they don't, they should know about Mahatma Gandhi and his nonviolent peace movement, which of course was something that inspired Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in this country as well, among other things. So there's that wonderful sort of civil rights connection that the story has. But beyond that, there was this wonderful national, nonviolence movement, but at the same time, India had what became the world's largest all-volunteer force in the Second World War on the Allied side.
I was not aware of that. No, very interesting.
Right, and hardly anyone knows that, and that includes a lot of Indians who think that India's role was just a footnote, or there were some odd people who said, my enemy's enemy is my friend, and tried to do silly things and, ally themselves with the wrong side. But there was this, huge contingent of people, and their contribution is completely forgotten, as are the contributions of, so many people from the former British colonies whose heroism was just not recognized by Britain, because by the time the Allies won the war and all of that was round about when these countries also became independent. So they were no longer British soldiers as far as they were concerned. So they didn't honor these people. And most of the time, the countries that became independent, like India, didn't care to honor them either, because they had fought in the British army as far as the nations were concerned. So they sort of had done so much for the freedom of the world. I mean, I'm convinced with all the research that I did that the war would not have been won if it hadn't been for the contributions of people like this. And it was, this group of unsung heroes, and someone I'm related to. The one of the wonderful things about being Indian is that you have a huge family, and you have all these marvelous characters. But my granduncle was part of this all-volunteer force, and he was born in a Brahmin family. So, with the four castes that you have in India, people often get this wrong. The Brahmins are the highest caste, but we are not wealthier. We're not by far the wealthiest. The caste is supposed to be one that dedicates itself to scholarly activity and priesthood and those sorts of things, to learning essentially. And Brahmins are not supposed to take up arms. And I was very surprised when I grew older to start to think about this man who had decided in a Brahmin family in the 1940s, when the caste system was, quite prevalent, to go against the family grain and take up arms. And, how this was viewed and all of that was something that I started to think about. And this man whom I, you know, was no longer alive became a sort of character in my mind. And I did do lots of research, talked to other people as well who had similar experiences or had similar people in their families, read letters, looked at photographs and all of this. But then as I started to write, as you know, when you start to write, some magical things start to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt as though I could hear this woman's voice, and she started to take over the story. And the story now is written in the voice of this young woman who is in the home where this young man is, and all of this is happening. And I saw this image of this young girl standing at the foot of a staircase that she was not allowed to climb just because she was a woman. And she was in this very conservative home where women were supposed to stay downstairs where the kitchen was, and only men were allowed to climb the stairs to get to the library.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
In a very sad sort of way. You know, of course, that the girl did climb those stairs and took that risk, and that girl's character is based on my own mother's character. And the book is called Climbing the Stairs.
I'll be sure to get a copy.
Thank you. So yeah, I mean, this story, you asked me how long it took to write. So it was here in my mind, and as I said, there were so many things that happened. First of all, there was one character that sort of inspired the story, but it ended up being told through the eyes of this other character. So she sort of took over, and her narrative was big. And if you read the novel, which I hope you do, you'll discover that the girl there is writing a diary. And so the first time I wrote the novel, start to finish, as a diary. And then I felt that it wasn't right. I rewrote the whole novel, start to finish, in third person.
Oh, wow.
And then, yes, I thought that I still hadn't got the voice right, but I thought it started and ended at the right place. So I rewrote the whole thing in first person, but it was no longer a diary. So my process was, as you can imagine, quite arduous.
Well, good for you for sticking to it. Some people would give up. You know, they would say, it's not working, I'll just do another story altogether. So.
Yeah. I mean, I loved the process of writing. It took me about 5 years, I think, probably. My second novel took me roughly then about 5 years as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you plot them out, or are you, like they say, a pantser, where it's just you write as you go? You don't have a fixed beginning or an end that you're aiming for?
I sort of wish I... I did outline, or I could. I don't say that. I shouldn't say that. But, you know, I do sometimes look at people that tell me that they have the plot, that they write straight to the plot. And, you know, one of the someone whose work is very well recognized and whom I like very, very much, Elliot Schreffer, who, you know, I think his work has been nominated for the National Book Award twice, said something which his process is so different from mine. I think he said he had a character given to him, he had a couple of plot points, and he wrote to those plot points, and he finished the novel, you know, quite quickly. And I think my process is, fortunately, unfortunately, very, very different, very sort of wandering and listening, and feels very organic. And then I sit back and look and cut some days, but it is that sort of feeling of being captured by a voice and writing for that voice, which is not necessarily a very logical process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be why it's also maybe a longer process for me. With Island's End as well, Island's End is my second novel, and it takes place in the Andaman Islands, which are off the coast of India, and beautiful, beautiful islands, rainforests, and coral reefs, where I actually worked when I was an oceanographer. And the indigenous people there, their culture really comes under threat. And the novel is about a young woman from one of these tribes that is chosen to be a spiritual leader of the tribe, which I think it's just fascinating that these people that, you know, so many of us would consider primitive actually would have women as leaders sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is about leadership, and I also sometimes now think about it and realize that in my own life, when I was an oceanographer, it's not quite that way anymore, but at that time it used to be a very, very male-dominated field. So I think in some way my own experiences as a chief scientist and the only woman and the only person of color but the leader on research vessels, that sort of thing probably played into the novel as well. So it's about leadership in a big way, about culture clash as well, about the rainforest and all the rest of it. So there's a lot going in that novel, and that was another one where I felt that I was, you know, sitting years and years after the experience, sitting halfway around the world in a cafe in Germany, felt I could hear this voice speaking sort of to me, wrote fervently for about a week, and then the voice was gone.
Oh, great.
So, exactly. So, you know, I thought, oh, my goodness. And, you know, when that happens, I don't pursue the voice either. So I think a lot of my writing is inspired. And if I'm not inspired, if I feel like I don't go chasing my haunting people, I guess, my ghosts or who is this, whatever you want. And my mind, so it took a while before that came back, and the people, actually, one of the things that's interesting to me is that the tsunami that came, you'd remember, the Boxing Day tsunami that, you know, went around the world and wreaked so much damage was something that affected the islands as well, and these people that we consider so primitive actually escaped, and the entire tribe, several of them actually, different tribes somehow knew and ran away.
Oh, wow.
Just in time. Yeah, and so that plays into the novel. And the funny thing was, I'd finished a draft of it ahead of time, and then after the tsunami, I just really felt as though I heard this voice come back and say we survived, and I Googled, because by then Googling was actually a verb in English, and I found out that they had survived, and then that plays into the novel as well. So there you go. It was also a long process.
And how long did A Time to Dance take?
Also probably about 5 years. And the next novel, I mean, they came out, I think, about 2 years apart, roughly, the first three. I think Climbing the Stairs was not 2008, maybe. And I think Island's End was 2012. Was it something? Oh, yes. Or 11, and then 3 years later was A Time to Dance about a year or two ago, and 2 years ago, I think. But the next one is going to be in 2019, so quite a while away.
Oh, my. What's the name of that, or you don't know yet?
I don't know yet for the first time. The other three, I think the titles worked very well. They were beautiful, I thought. I liked them very much. I picked all three titles, and they stuck. But unfortunately, with the one that I'm just writing, my editor, Nancy Paulson, doesn't like the title at all. She's a brilliant editor, and so I trust that she will work with me to find a suitable title. But she was quite funny. She said, you know, all these lovely things. The book was just signed up this summer. But the book was called Wherever You Are, and she said to me, that she loved this book, felt it had, you know, the makings of a classic, all these marvelous things, which I was so happy to hear. But then she also said, at the end, she said, but the title, oh my goodness, it sounds like one of those books that you think, oh, it was so wonderful, but what the heck was it called?
It is more distinctive, I guess.
Okay. I guess, yeah. It's called Wherever You Are, which I like, but my husband actually said it sounded like a cheap romance, so.
Oh my. Can you discuss how you got from your first novel being written to finding an agent, I presume, and then getting published? Can you talk about that?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly. I'm very happy to talk about that, because I think that I had about 35 agents reject me.
Oh, my.
Before, yes, and it was quite shocking to me because I had sort of dabbled in writing before. When I was an oceanographer, I still enjoyed the process of writing, so I thought maybe I would stay in touch with writing by writing articles about science for newspapers. So for a very long time, for several years, I wrote for one of the foremost Indian newspapers, and I wrote a science column. And I also wrote for, you know, once in a while, I wrote for magazines in the States, and sometimes even for children's magazines. So I sort of translated science for the lay person, and I felt, and you know, these were very well-known, well-established magazines. So I thought that I had a publishing record that would be recognized, that people would be happy about, that they would be, you know, I wouldn't come in as just an unpublished writer. And plus my, you know, when I read my cover letter, I think it was quite smart. It spoke about the fact that there was this family connection that I had to the book. It's World War II. Nobody even knew about World War II in India. There's just so much in that novel.
Right. So much of World War II is Europe and the Pacific. And you don't hear much about, like, North Africa and India.
Exactly. And so I would have thought that that would be very interesting. But somehow nobody wanted to touch it. And again, I got rejections where no one wanted to even read the synopsis in the first 5 chapters. And then suddenly it felt like a flood. I think 3 agents bit all together at the same time. And then I took the first one who called me up and said that she had cried and cried, and she said she had finished 3 boxes of tissues or something on the novel. So.
Oh, my goodness. Well, remarkable. Very good for you.
Right. Right. So, you know, once the agent was found, it was sold to Penguin within what felt like no time, and of course Penguin is, you know, the world's largest publishing house now, especially because they merged with the Random House, there's no question. So what can I tell you? I think it's a lovely message though to know that it was rejected 35 times, because I think so many people out there have brilliant manuscripts that are not necessarily snapped up. And I think it's a good thing to know that success doesn't necessarily come immediately, doesn't. Yeah.
And have you stayed with this agent since, or have you changed agents?
I have changed agents since then. I certainly love Barbara Markowitz, who was my first agent, but she was, you know, getting closer to retirement. I believe now she's not accepting any new clients and so on. And I also wanted to broaden my wings a little, so I wanted to stretch out in different directions with my writing, which I have to say hasn't yet happened, but I certainly hope with your blessings and everybody else's that it will happen someday. I am now with Rob Weisbach, and I moved to him for several reasons, and particularly that he represents books for grown-ups, and books for young people, and books that are picture books. So he does everything. He does the entire gamut. And I want, hopefully, if I live long enough, by the time I die, I'll have a nice long record with lots of different kinds of books.
I hope your wish comes true.
I hope so as well. We will see. I also think that some of the authors that I admire the most are writers who've been able to who push themselves to write differently each time. So, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro, he's a Japanese and British author. So a British author of Japanese origin or heritage, and has written brilliant works. So I think one of his science fiction novels it was actually made into a movie recently, so it's probably the most well-known. Of course, now I can't think of the name of it. But he wrote something before that that was historical fiction and that took place both in the past and the present. You know, then moved from that to something that was science fiction, but literary science fiction, beautifully written. When You Reach Me, no, that was Rebecca said. What am I saying? It was something else. Anyways, and then now he's recently written a novel that is sounds or seems to be sort of inspired by King Arthur and all the rest of it. So I think people like that who push themselves to do very different kinds of work, I find especially interesting and astonishing because they don't just say, I write real estate books and I will do that again and again, but they push themselves to do something different. And I think with my three novels, they are quite different from each other. You know, Climbing the Stairs is historical fiction. Island's End is certainly not. And some people have called it magic realism, which isn't. It isn't quite. And I was very thrilled when one professor told me that I invented a new genre. But, you know, it has a lot of dream state things in it because it tries to reflect the beliefs and the belief system of the indigenous people. So it's, you know, it's a very different kind of novel. And then one of the starred reviews that came out called it action-packed, which is, you know, interesting because my work comes, I think, from character, and it's not necessarily what you associate with action-packed, but when I look back at it, heart-stopping action, they said, and I guess it is. So, you know, there was that, and then, of course, there's A Time to Dance, which is all about spirituality and written as a verse novel. So Island's End is sort of lush, rich prose that, you know, luxuriates in words. And I wanted after that to push myself to the other extreme, which is A Time to Dance, which is just lean, spare, minimalist prose. So in that way as well, I hope to experiment and push myself.
And how do you do that? How do you personally hone your writing craft? What do you... Do you do, like, little sketches? I mean, how do you go from writing something that's, as you say, lush to something that's more minimalist? How do you know what, I mean, you know, how do you take advantage of a vocabulary and I don't know how to describe it, but just how would you say you just improve yourself consciously?
I think some of it is probably unconscious. Some of it, the conscious part, I think, is just reading people that I like. And I don't think that it necessarily then, I mean, I don't think, and I have seen strange things happen in this world, but I'm certainly not somebody who would, I hope, ever, you know, look at something and try to imitate it. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I think, it almost feels as if when I'm writing the lush, rich prose, I'm reading the minimalist prose artists or the poets. And then the other way around, one thing, though, that I have done consistently and I love to do is read poetry. Mm-hmm. So I think honing my craft, I think reading a lot of poets, contemporary poets and poets of old, I don't judge. I don't have a degree in literature, so I don't have any sort of snobbery associated with any particular type of writing. And for me, poetry is such a very beautiful, interesting medium. And I do push myself to write poetry. I've never dared to publish it or send it in that direction because I am quite critical of my own work, and I don't think it's good enough. But that's something that I think helps me somehow. Mm-hmm. So I think reading and writing poetry is something that I do. With plotting, that's probably, for me, the hardest. But I try very consciously at some stage of the game. I mean, I told you I write in a sort of organic way, but then when I sit back, I do feel sometimes as though you have to cultivate a kind of schizophrenia. You have to find the writer in you that just pours out everything on the page and I sometimes call it verbal vomit, and then come in, and then, you know, you have to also develop the other persona, which is the one that cleans, you know, with bleach, and gets rid of most of it. And I think sometimes when I'm in the vomity phase, then I have, you know, the editor Padma who shows up and says, that's not such a nice word, that's not so beautiful. And then that's the time you have to send her away and you have to tell her to shut up and get lost, because what you want to be able to do is just write and not be judgmental. And then you have the other person, you know, when the editor is on, or when she's in the driving seat, if you will, then you have to let go of the other Padma, the Padma that writes and is in love with every word she's ever written and every image that's ever come into her brain and then got onto the page, because then that Padma is saying, oh, it's so beautiful, I worked so hard on this line, you can't just get rid of it. You know, so you have to be able to chop things quite brutally.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, I think if you can dissociate those two sides of yourself, it's worked for me. I'm not saying it has to work for everybody, but I think that helps a lot.
When you, for any of your novels, when you turned in your draft, your manuscript, was there an editing process that shocked you, like, or was it just, you know, some simple suggestions? Like, was there an overhaul? Like, some people say, I had to change the structure, for example, or I had to, you know, one character wasn't working, that you needed to tone that person up a bit more. Or was it pretty easy as far as the feedback you got from the editors?
I wouldn't call it necessarily easy. I think I have Nancy Paulson is a brilliant editor. So, and a person with a lot of experience, so she certainly has a vision and gives you a tremendous amount of feedback, which is wonderful. There may be times when you disagree, when you discuss something, but in the end, I think for me, it's never been brutal. I've never felt like I needed to give it an overhaul, which, don't get me wrong, there are days that I look there and I think desperately, oh my goodness, how will I ever rise to this challenge? How will I ever finish? I mean, it isn't by far as though I believe in myself every day and I'm cruising along and I'm sailing and it's just all perfect.
Well, that's reassuring to me, because I certainly have those days.
Yeah, so it isn't like that at all. And then, you know, there are questions she asks. A lot of times it's questions. And there's certainly the times when, you know, she might say, look, I think you want me to feel bad, but I feel like laughing. I know she doesn't say it quite that way, but you know what I mean?
Yes.
The emotion just isn't working or something. And I think that's what, to me, my work is about, not getting drenched in emotion in a sort of sentimental, ridiculous way, but it has to touch your heart.
Yes.
And if it doesn't, then, you know, what's the point?
But well, in the time to dance, I was right with her when she was mooning over her doctor, just that crush she had for Jim. It was very adorable, and I was right there with her on that. It was very, very touching.
Thank you. You know, it's funny because I've been, you know, now that I write books that are accessible to young adults, I have read young adult literature a lot, and you'd be amazed at how often it feels as though there's this teenage love affair that is just so intense and going to last your lifetime, and when the fact of the matter is that it doesn't necessarily happen that way, and I would hazard a guess that it doesn't happen that way most of the time. Uh-huh. You know, because there's such a lot of change. So I think there was a part of me that wanted her to be just a normal teenager, you know, to have these crazy things happen and live through them and get over the embarrassment and the awkwardness, because I do think adolescence is an awkward phase in some ways, but also there's such a lot of richness to it. So I wanted the character to have both, to be a real person, you know?
Oh, yes. Oh, that came across. But yeah. I don't recall if it was specified. How old was Veda in the story? Is it? Is that? I was thinking 14, 15, but maybe I'm off. I don't know.
You know, I'm not going to tell you because however old she is in your mind is right.
Okay.
For you. And part of the reason I didn't specify an age was I think it was Stephen, actually, who said you don't need to do that. Mm-hmm. And it was partly because the novel takes place in India, and Indian teens, what they're allowed to do, what they go through is quite different from what a teenager goes through here. Mm-hmm. And in a historical fiction novel like Climbing the Stairs, it's easy enough to say, okay, she's so many years old, and then it's fine because that's, you know, it's a different time period and all the rest of it. Or an entirely different culture. With this being a contemporary novel, I thought, and, you know, Nancy suddenly also later agreed with me, it doesn't need, and I don't think she ever had an issue with it, was just, let's not mention that too much, because I think very quickly when you see a character on a page, you make an emotional connection with that person, hopefully.
Yes.
And then you start to imagine. So I think we're gone from the days when we didn't have films and we had somebody like Charles Dickens, who I do think is brilliant, you know. Some people think he's not, and all the and I think that's a bunch of nonsense. Just because E.M. Forster didn't like his work, it doesn't mean that all of us have to also. That's ridiculous, yeah. I mean, E.M. Forster was a bit of an ass, actually, in many ways, I think. With his views, anyway. It doesn't mean it was a bad novelist. It just means he was a bit of an ass. Anyway, he was such a colonialist, white supremacist in his own way. I come from the country that he described in such a ridiculous fashion that I can't feel too sympathetic towards him.
Certainly understandable.
Yeah, you know, even though I can admire his writing. The two things are quite different. But Dickens would sort of give you, you knew how that person's toenails looked.
Right.
And I think we've moved away from that. You don't need to do that anymore, because I think when you describe to that degree, especially if you do it on page 5 and you've met the character already on page 1, the person may have formed this idea of the character that doesn't fit.
Well, you touch upon something that seems counterintuitive. I think you're correct. But it would seem like today would be the time when authors would be over-detailed in physical descriptions, right? Because you're competing with movies where you have the visual right in front of you. And it seems it's interesting to think about the way you're describing how, you know, a century and more ago. But you got to also think they were paid by the word, so I guess they, you know, they were indulgent for that reason as well. But it's just interesting.
Right. But actually, you do have cinematic writing, so, you know, maybe I was thinking more. There is cinematic writing in sort of genre fiction a lot, I think. You mm-hmm. see that. And that's fine. It's just a different way to write. Mm-hmm. But I think there is, to some degree, I think we're conscious. There are people who, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but to me, the people who do sort of cinematic writing are the ones that are into more genre fiction. They're into plot mm-hmm. much more than they really are into character. To me, character is about emotion. Mm-hmm. And it's about making that connection, that link in a very deep way. Because I think a character in a novel is somebody who has to grab you so deeply that you don't feel sympathy, you never feel sympathetic toward a character. You have to feel empathy with the character, which is a very different thing. You have to identify, you know, feel that character's emotions. And to do that, I don't think cinematic writing is necessarily important. But if maybe you want to write a ghost story or something that is more captivating of the senses as opposed to the heart and the emotion, maybe that's the sort of thing that I visualize as, or I think about as cinematic writing, where the sort of visual visualization of a scene becomes more important than perhaps the emotional heart of a scene, which is not to say that the two don't necessarily exist or coexist or overlap to some degree, but I think there is a certain type of writing in which that takes precedence. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. In your own writing, are there ways you check yourself to make sure you're engaging emotionally rather than cinematically, let's say? I mean, are there techniques you use to make sure you're really drawing the reader in empathetically? I haven't analyzed your book in that way, so I'm not sure. It worked. Whatever it was, it worked, so...
Yeah, I don't know that I do. I don't know that I do. There are places that I think I tend to overwrite. And I think that somebody said there are those who write too much and there are those who write too little. And I tend to do too much. And then, you know, Nancy cuts it, or my editor would sort of cut out things. And sometimes there are descriptions that maybe... she cuts out, but I think she's cutting out so that we get to the emotion more, or the emotion becomes more poignant. I don't know that I do that in a conscious way. I do know that I've just written my first fantasy. When that ever comes out, I don't know, but that is much more cinematic. And that's not to say that I don't, you know, the characters are very important to me. The emotions are extremely important. But that kind of a world, that kind of sort of otherworldly experience that I want to create, perhaps, to me, demands more of that cinematic writing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to get also to back to A Time to Dance, where faith and tradition are prominent in the book. And I love that. And, I go to a lot of what we have here in Richmond, writing shows. And I love the ones about craft. But what doesn't come up as often is faith and tradition, writing about that. Because you spoke about it earlier in our conversation about you didn't want it to be, proselytizing. You know,
right.
How do you write about faith in a way that seems sincere from the character's point of view without being, pedantic or kind of rubs the reader the wrong way?
I think anytime you want to put words into the character's mouth that you, in terms of religion anyway, that you just really are a little too fond of, and you want to expand and go on and on, you need to watch that.
Okay.
So I think if you are writing about faith, it's extremely important that you check yourself to make sure that your character is speaking and that you are not trying to speak through your character.
Very good, yeah.
So the character has to be saying something that is fully that character's own voice, that character's own words. It's not Padma trying to get on, Padma speaking from the pulpit through this mask of a character. And right. As long as you're conscious of that and making very, very sure that doesn't happen, because it's easy for that to happen, especially with something as strong as, a religion or a faith, when somebody feels that, it can happen that way. And I think that's what you have to keep on watch, keep on checking yourself. When you go back through the novel, and it may be pages and pages, it may take you a long while, but question, is this character really saying this, or am I trying to say this through her or him?
Wow, that's a good take on that. And how important is faith to Veda? It seems very important to me, but how important was it in the book for you, I guess?
To me, her whole journey is that journey of faith. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ask me to talk about the most important thing in the book, it isn't. It is a character's spiritual awakening. And as I said, that's one of the rarest themes that's ever dealt with, because it's very difficult to talk about spiritual awakening without it becoming religious proselytization.
Right.
And so I'm very happy that I did do it, but I think it's also something that isn't recognized, how difficult a theme that is, how rare a theme that is, and how extremely hard it is to pull it off. And to me, it is the most important thing in the book. If you ask me, you know, to change everything and not give up one thing about the novel, that's the thing I wouldn't give up. Mm. You know, the heart of the novel, if you will, is her spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. Her discovery of spirituality in that personal way, what it means to her.
Especially out of tragedy. Tragic circumstances,
right,
where some other people might just be turned off altogether and closed, right, and shut down. She got through it.
Right. Right. It is, you know, so for several people, though, it is also the trigger. I think it's something that pushes you one way or another sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Or so it seems.
I think subtextually, you also had the theme of gratitude, which is,
yes,
which I'm big on. I love, I think that's a very important quality to have, is gratitude in your life.
Yeah.
And I think I picked up on that too. Is that something you wove in, or is it just me reading too much into it?
No, I think it is very, very, very important. And, you know, there's that and there's something else. I don't want it to come off sounding like I do these things, because I don't. And I mean, I'm as guilty as the next person of failing these all the time. But I think it is extremely important, and I don't think I am as grateful enough of the time for all the good things that I have. I don't think I see it as much as I should. I don't think. Also, the other thing that to me is so important in Veda's story is the ability to really strive to do your best, to put your heart and your soul and your mind and your entire life into something like a book. In Veda's case, dance, whatever it might be, art or science or whatever it is that you enjoy and that is, you know, something that you love, to be able to give yourself to it completely and then at some level, like a bolt that you, you know, created from scratch, let it go and let it sail on the sea alone and watch it go.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have, you know, you may have storms that try to capsize the boat, and there's just absolutely nothing you can do about it. And I think, you know, as it happens to us in several different ways, I'm sure parenthood is something like that as well. You have a child, you're so completely involved, you do your best, and then you have to let go. And in that same way with a book, I think it's sort of your intellectual child, and you do the very best you possibly can. And it's very, very, very hard to let it go, especially in this day and age, because we no longer live, unfortunately, in the times that, you know, J.D. Salinger lived. And I would love to do that. I would love to just, you know, be in my sort of cabin in the woods, in the sense that I don't... I don't want to do necessarily any publicity or anything, you know, just be happy, I love meeting people. I love talking about my work, but also I think I don't really like electronic media and stuff that's beeping and screeching at me all the time. I've found ways to do it that I'm comfortable with now, but it's not something that I gravitate towards. And especially in this day and age when authors are just expected to do so much, which I think is sort of sometimes unreasonable, because most of us, I think the best of us, are introverted, and the best of us are not necessarily always the best marketers. Sometimes people who market brilliantly and don't have a product that's as brilliant, you know, get a long, 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 long way. But you can't afford to let that, get you down. And that's very, very hard, I think, to just say, okay, I've done my best, and now I have to let it go. Well, I don't necessarily do that. Veda does in the novel much better than I do.
Well, you lead me into how I wanted to finish our conversation, which was about marketing and platform and how you get the word out about your books. I agree with you. I mean, I'd rather be writing than doing any of that.
Right.
But do you have a website? Do you tweet? Do you, you know, what are your, because certainly that pressure is out there. I'm told all the time, you know, you have to have these things. And I wonder sometimes, is it as effective as they say?
I don't know whether it is that effective or not. I was very, very lucky this summer in that I had been told, I've been told for a long time, that I have a horrible website. And then this this intern, this young woman that I, you know, quite out of the blue, came, it was completely like a godsend, came in and said to me that she would like to work with me, and her dream job would be to be an editor or a marketing person for an author, and she loved my work, and could she intern with me? And I didn't have to pay her. She, you know, arranged for the whole thing on her own. And she came, and she did a brilliant job of helping me to update my website and make it very, very accessible and wonderful. So, yes, I have a website that I'm actually extremely proud of now.
And what is the address?
It's www.padmasbooks.com, PADMASBOOKS, without any punctuation or anything, .com. But you can also do www.padmavenkatraman.com. So just my full name, my first name, Padma, and Venkatraman, VENKATRAMAN.com. And you should get to it. So whichever way you do it, you should get to the website. And yeah, actually, I like it a lot now. So I actually go and put things on it. I'm on Twitter. Yes, she taught me how to do that. And yes, so I think after she showed up in my life, I think I went from, well, being a complete zero on Twitter because it didn't exist for me, to being, you know, I think she was very excited. She said, oh, look, we have something, followers, and I don't know. So anyway, I started to do that sort of thing. The way that I do it now, and I have been thinking about something that I'd like to do with my blog soon. I haven't started doing it yet, so it's a bit scary to talk about it, so I won't. But that I would like to do, so that I put things on it much more frequently in it. And that the blog, again, is something you can access through the website. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be fun. And I realized that I had to do something that I enjoyed. So with Twitter, what I have been doing right now is just to take photographs of books that I usually have in my library and maybe do a quote from a book. It's not necessarily the most unique thing to do. I think lots of people do that sort of thing, but it's something that I actually like to do. And so I think that helps. I think it helps to be able to find something that you don't see as a chore that you can actually put out there. I'm very conscious of my family's privacy. I don't want to invade that. And, you know, people have different ideas of that, and that's fine. I think, you know, as a family, you decide. But for me, I do not want to be speaking about their private lives in any way on the internet, and it's something that I think is very, very popular these days. Lots of people do that, and it's just not what I want to do. And I realize that people want to make a personal connection with you, so there are some things that I don't mind sharing, but there are other things that I think are wrong of me anyway, that just does not feel right for me to share. So I do not write things about, you know, personal issues. So I think I go so far with my marketing. I do a lot, but not as much as other people do. And to me, it's when I feel like, which is often about once a week, but not every day. I really enjoy my days when I don't do anything electronic, when I've shut it off and I don't do that. And, you know, some people said that's not a good work ethic. You should do it every day. And to me, I think my work ethic is that I write every day, that I write, you know, my actual books every day. And it isn't necessarily that I do something electronically every day. So, you know, I think that's how I operate. I really enjoy people that I've met and, you know, staying in touch with them. That's a different thing. And I don't consider that to be necessarily marketing, but I think when I make actual human contact with someone, that's something that I value. And hopefully, in some way, that is considered to be furthering my contacts or whatever by people that, the powers that be, because to me it's just something that I enjoy doing, and hopefully it fits into that category of publicity and marketing somehow.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time, Edna.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did, and I found it informative.
Thank you. And I look forward very much to meeting you in Richmond very soon.
Yes, likewise. Definitely can't wait to meet you. Take care. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.